From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll speak with soprano Jessi Norman, one of the superstars of the opera world. Her singing inspired the film Diva. Also, I'll talk with newspaper obituary writer Jim Nicholson. Instead of writing the death notices of movers and shakers, he celebrates the lives of the working class. Book critic John Leonard reviews Waltzing with a Dictator, former New York Times reporter Raymond Bonner's book about U.S. relations with Ferdinand Marcos. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back to the days when the Beatles were just another struggling Liverpool band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me now is diva Jessi Norman. Since making her debut as Elizabeth in the 1969 Berlin Opera production of Tannhäuser, Jessi Norman has become one of the most sought-after and praised sopranos in all of opera. Critics have lauded her opulent, dark-hued voice for its dramatic projection. On stage, Jessi Norman is renowned for a commanding, regal presence. Writing of her Elizabeth, Donald Hanahan of the New York Times said, "Norman exuded an irresistible magnetism and showed what is meant by acting with the voice." Norman's American career is relatively new compared with her extensive work in Europe, where she's the reigning prima donna of our time. In fact, the adulation of a young fan inspired the film Diva. Jessi Norman was born in Augusta, Georgia, and she now lives in London and New York. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you
here. Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Before we talk, I'd love to play a recording by you. And we're going to hear you singing a song by Schubert with Philip Mohl accompanying you at the piano.
Dem Schnee, dem Regen, dem Wind entgegen, im Dorf begrüßt ein durch Schnee Lippe, immer zu, immer zu, und er rast und ruh. Lieb oder schreiben, wollt ich mich schlagen, als so will Freude des Lebens ertragen. Schande das Neigen von Herzen zu Herzen, ach, wie so eigen schafft etwas Schmerzen. Wie soll ich flinten, aber ziehen, alles eines Vergehens? Krone des Lebens, Glück ohne Ruh, Liebe bist du, Liebe bist du, Glück ohne Ruh, Liebe bist du, Krone des Lebens, Glück ohne Ruh, Liebe bist du, Liebe bist du,
That was my guest, Jessi Norman. Jessi Norman, how were you exposed to opera when you were a child?
I was exposed to opera as a child first by hearing opera on the radio. I was and still am a devoted fan of those Texaco broadcasts of the Metropolitan Opera live on Saturdays. And I spent a great deal of time as a child listening to these broadcasts. And I didn't have any pretensions of understanding what the music was about or what the story was about. I was dependent upon the announcer to tell me about that. And I certainly didn't know anything about singing, but I was intrigued by it all, and I loved it, and I listened every Saturday, even though a lot of my friends thought it was just something weird and odd that I did. But I enjoyed it without really understanding what sort of drew me to it. I studied piano as a young child, but I wasn't by any means an opera singer at 6 or 7 years old. I didn't really know what it all meant, except that I loved it.
I bet your friends did think you were weird because most kids listen to pop music and
of
not
course.
To opera.
And certainly then as well, listening very much to pop and sort of to Elvis Presley and all of these things, you know, that one was sort of meant to love. And I was very fond of symphonic music and chamber music and listening to the opera.
You didn't take singing lessons when you were young.
No, I didn't. Very fortunately, I didn't have singing lessons until I went to university. And that was just a lucky thing. Somehow my parents understood and really wanted me to go on singing as a child, which I did all the time, just everywhere, with this interest and the love for it that I had already. And they rather felt that I think if I had lessons that I might have started to take it and myself much too seriously, and that somehow this natural enjoyment might have gone away, which of course would have been just too bad. And so I wasn't given lessons at all. I was given piano lessons, and I was, you know, sort of learning the rudiments of music, as it were, but certainly not anything about singing.
What an interesting perspective for parents to have, because I think, yes. In fact, a lot of children are musically ruined by the obligation of lessons.
Yes, precisely. But my parents were certainly my earliest fans. I've always said that. But they were I didn't at all have a stage mother. I mean, I didn't have a mom who had wanted to sing at some point in her own life professionally and hadn't quite done it or something and was sort of pushing me. They were always extremely supportive, but not in any way sort of trying to make me do something that perhaps they hadn't done in their own lives. Not at all.
When you got older and wanted to start auditioning for scholarships and for colleges, were you aware of how few Black singers had actually gained acceptance in the opera world?
Well, I knew that there were few, but I didn't think that there was any justification for it. And therefore, it wasn't something that I worried about or something that in my own mind held me back, because I had certainly all of the enthusiasm required for this job. And I didn't see why I couldn't be trained for it simply because of my color. And I didn't think that was a valid reason for not pursuing it at all.
You came of age during the civil rights movement.
Absolutely.
Did
yes.
that make you more determined to break in and to not worry about barriers that might exist?
Well, I wouldn't doubt that this certainly gave me a certain impetus and perhaps a certain feeling for really wanting to go ahead and to accomplish what was my ideal at the time. I certainly, at the same time, have to say that I was also interested in medicine when it was time for me to go to university, and that it was just a series of happy events that made it possible for me to go off and study music. And I certainly, as a young student, I wasn't thinking at all about the possibility, when I'm really honest, of becoming a professional musician. This was something that I did because I loved it and I wanted to know how to do it properly. And I certainly had no idea as to how to become a professional singer. That wasn't the part that they taught you. You learned about musical analysis and orchestration and harmony and this kind of thing and sight singing and music literature. But there was no course as to what do you do now that you've studied singing for a few years. Certainly not.
Did any well-meaning teachers ever take you aside and said, look, we have to just be honest with you. You'll never make it in the world of opera because you're Black.
Oh, no. That never, ever happened. Absolutely not. And thank goodness it didn't. I'm not sure, really, that it would have had a great effect on me if someone had said that. That would, knowing me, that would have just given me more determination. But I was very lucky in that people were very supportive of me. I mean, my first grade teacher was very supportive of me, who suggested, that was the first time that I remember being asked to stand up and sing on my own outside of, you know, the things that I had done at the church already, was to be asked to sing alone at the school. I mean, we were huge. I mean, sort of the post-war baby boom is a real thing. And we were so many people. I mean, we had to go to school in shifts. I mean, some people went to school from 8 until 1 and others went from school from 1 to 6 or something. I mean, it was terrible. There were so many of us. But so there were a lot of kids at the school, and I was asked to sing for them in my first year. I was 6 years old, and I wasn't daunted. I just thought, well, this is great, and it was wonderful to be asked to sing by myself.
A lot of Black singers end up having to sing Porgy and Bess a lot because it's the opera where Black singers are most readily cast. Did you go through that?
Been a rite of passage for a lot of singers, and they've done incredibly well outside of the music of Gershwin, you know, after having had a platform on which they could be heard. And this is something that, because other singers have gone through this before my time, I didn't have to start a career by singing various roles in Porgy and Bess. I was invited to Vienna and to Munich and to Frankfurt to sing recitals that included the music of Schubert and Brahms and Schumann without having to prove that I could sing anything else. I was allowed to learn this music in front of the German audiences there. And that's a lucky break. And that is something that happened for me because there were singers who went before me and took the hard knocks and were not perhaps considered in their professions that they should have been.
Jesse Norman is my guest. You really started your career in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Are there advantages for a singer to start in Germany and
well,
not America?
Well, there are certain advantages, I think, if one is really honest, about starting out in Europe, simply because there are more places to sing. I've often said that in a country, in Germany, the size of what, the state of Tennessee, maybe, or something like that, there are about, certainly more than 50 full-time opera houses. So it is possible for a country this size to sort of take in, certainly in that time anyway, to take in Americans and people from other countries as well, to sing in these opera houses, because they're not dependent on us young singers for the box office, since they give, you know, in the course of the year, perhaps 70 to 80 different operas, that it is possible for us to go in there and learn something about this job and learn the repertoire without the pressure of needing to be able to do something that perhaps is a box office attraction, or certainly when one is not a box office attraction oneself, to be able to sing in these places, to get some experience, yes.
Do you think that German audiences and producers were any more or less racially conscious than American, than their American counterparts?
I think that one has to realize that for many people, going to the opera in Europe is like going to the movies or going shopping or doing anything that is a natural part of one's existence. And I think that I really can't imagine that in Germany, at least I never felt this overtly, that they were concerned about the race of the singers. I don't really think so.
When did you know it was right for you to make your debut in America and to have a base in America?
Well, I've been singing. The one thing that I want to point out is that I've been singing in the States for as long as I've been singing professionally, period. But you see, I've been singing with orchestras, and I've been singing recitals with piano. I haven't been singing in sort of rather more, I think probably the rather more high-profile aspect of this profession, and that is singing in the opera. And as I've only been doing that in this country for the last 5 years, perhaps that's what you mean by sort of having a base and singing in America. But I have been a part of the music scene here since I've been singing, you know, for the last 17 years.
I had read somewhere that from 75 to 80, mm-hmm. you did very little performing.
Well, I didn't do any performing of opera on stage. That's what's meant by that comment. I was a member of the company and living in Berlin from 70 until that time. And it became very clear to me that in order to have the kind of vocal development that I knew was absolutely necessary for me, that I needed to do this outside of the confines of an opera house, where it really was necessary to be able to say a year and sometimes 2 years in advance what role would really suit my voice. And I simply was in no position to do that. My voice seemed to be changing, if not yearly, maybe weekly. And I wasn't prepared to have my voice suffer from having to do roles that are simply only now suited to my voice, that could not have in any way have been considered appropriate for a singer of 24, 25 years old.
Do you feel like your voice is still changing?
Oh, yes, it is.
How?
It's still changing in that I feel from day to day much more in control of what comes out of my throat, simply because I know so much more and understand so much more about my own vocal possibilities and the requirements that I make of it. I understand how to treat these requirements that I have that are going on in my head. I understand how to produce these sounds vocally without hurting myself, and with the ability to really convey what it is I'm thinking. And that is simply, I think, maturity and a certain amount of development vocally. I mean, the maybe the voice has gotten larger in some ways, and the extensions on the bottom and the top are somehow more solid, and all of that kind of technical stuff that happens from just practicing for 17 years.
You said earlier that your voice is still changing a little bit,
yeah,
and that you're getting
sure.
more and more control
oh, sure.
of it.
Oh,
what
yes.
do you do as a singer to make sure that you have longevity with your voice, that it's going to last.
Well, one tries to have a kind of reasonable life because, after all, you know, unlike a pianist or a flautist or someone else whose instrument is it is possible to put in a box and take around with you, this one lives inside of me, and when I have a cold, it has a cold as well. And so one has to try to live a reasonable life and not to sort of sit in drafts and to wear a coat when it's cold. And a hat when it's raining and all those reasonable things. Other than that, I try not to fuss. I don't pack myself off in cotton wool, trying to sort of keep away from the germs of the world. I think that one has to try to live a life as well as live a profession.
Well, I want to play another one of your recordings, but before we do, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is Jesse Norman, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer Jesse Norman is my guest. I'd like to play another one of your recent recordings, and this time we're going to hear you singing a song by Strauss. Do you want to say anything about the song before we hear it?
Oh, Mit deinen blauen Augen. It's one of those wonderful love songs for which Strauss seemed to have a special empathy, and it's certainly one of my favorites.
Let's listen. Sung by Strauss, performed by my guest Jesse Norman, Jeffrey Parsons accompanying her at the piano. Very beautiful.
Thank you.
The way I understand it, your relationship to a fan of yours and his adulation of you inspired the film Diva.
Yes, indeed. He used to really work for the post office delivering telegrams. Indeed he did.
Don't tell me more about this.
Well, he is one of these people. Unfortunately, he died last year. I mean, this is a very sad thing to think about when I remember his devotion to music and to me personally. But I don't know how much a person can make, sort of what kind of salary a person can make from delivering telegrams. But whatever it was, he spent all of that money going to concerts. And he has simply been one of these people. I mean, he started this when he was in high school, about 14 years old or something. He started coming to my performances in France. And not only did he come to my performances in Paris where he lived, but he traveled all around Europe. You know, on the train in various places, sometimes traveling overnight. I mean, not in sort of the most luxurious end of the train at all, but to come to performances. He was that devoted. It was a very special relationship. I miss him a lot.
What is like your responsibility to a fan who's so devoted to you? I know they don't want anything in return except for the music, but you must feel like you really have to do something special
I mean, when you know that a person like Alain, was his name, is sitting in the audience, he would sit on the front row, and where he ever got the money to buy all these dozens and hundreds of flowers he's given to me over the years, I shall never know. But it certainly would make one want to give one's very best performance, because obviously it meant a great deal to him. And certainly I would hope to, you know, a lot of other people as well. But to a person who's really willing to go to that extreme to hear performances, one has a special responsibility to get it right for them.
Did you see the film Diva that was inspired
by
you?
Yes, and I had to laugh because really Benix had been to certain performances of mine, and in conversations with various friends of mine, he'd gotten a rather lot of information that is in that film, and it's really rather funny.
Oh, you mean personal information?
Yes, exactly, like sort of, you know, about what kind of dress I might have worn at a performance in Bordeaux, or the name of one of my managers in Europe or something, or at that time, my hesitancy about making recordings and all of this kind of thing. It was really very strange.
So you really were reluctant to make recordings?
Yes, because I was very uncomfortable in a recording situation, because I really feel very much that my singing is for people, for audiences, for people that are in front of me at the time.
What broke you down?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it's just experience and doing it and realizing that this was a very important part of my professional life. And I'm much more comfortable with the recording situation these days. But I was really, it was just practically torture when I first started doing it, because I simply didn't know how to approach it. I didn't understand about having to go into a room sort of covered with microphones and to give a performance. I needed something to come back. I needed to see someone's face, or at least be able to see my accompanist out of the side of my eye or something. But in a situation like that, because of the microphones having to be placed in a certain way, very often I was on one side of the room and the accompanist was on the other side. Or singing an opera with an orchestra. I mean, the singers are very much removed so that we don't, to use a technical term, sort of bleed into the microphone of maybe the drummer or the horn player or the conductor or whatever. It was just an unnatural situation that I simply had to learn how to use to my advantage.
Were you able to manipulate it so you could create a warmer, more congenial
atmosphere? Yes, I started inviting people to come to the sessions.
Oh, what a good idea.
And they had to promise to sit absolutely still without making a noise, without even breathing. But it became really necessary for me to create a real situation in which I could perform.
I want to get back to your fans for a second. You obviously have very devoted fans. Mm. Are any of them ever real wacky so that they worry you a little bit?
Well, some people, one has to be very careful about one's, I think, the attentions that might be given one from the public. And we have to keep these things, I think, in perspective and to understand, first of all, the power of music and how people can become so devoted to having listened to one particular thing that you might have performed at some point, and that this becomes for them what you are. And one has to simply understand that the person and the performer live in the same body, but they need different things. And I need peace and quiet as much as I need applause.
So you have to politely ask your most devoted fans to leave at a certain point.
Yes, exactly. Now the performance is over. We have spoken to each other after performance, and now I have to go off by myself, or with people that are close enough to me who would understand if I don't feel like talking for an hour.
Now that you're a veteran, do you know how to do that better than you used to?
Oh, yes.
Because I think it's something you really have to learn, probably.
I think so. But I'm sure that the people who come to my performances and who take the time to come to see me afterwards are made to feel at home and welcome when they do come.
You know, I wanted to ask you something else about Diva. I was just thinking, in the movie, another characteristic of the singer in the movie is that she's an American who's moved to France, and she can't speak the language very well at all. And she has this terrible French accent. Yeah, was this a trait of yours?
No, I speak French very well. And I don't deny that I'm certain that from time to time Americanisms come into my speech. I'm kind of a conglomeration of all the places that I've lived in my speech anyway.
Do you think you're chameleon-like with languages? You pick up the sounds of where you're living?
Yes, very easily. Yes, very easily. But I don't think that I have an American accent when I speak French. Alors, j'espère, non.
Several of your recent albums are recordings of spirituals.
Uh-huh.
Now, I was wondering if spirituals are very close to your heart.
Or certainly. Okay. They are a natural part of my existence. I mean, like air and water and spring and autumn, all these things. And I feel that this is something that I've always had in me, something that's always been around me since my earliest remembrances of music and of life, really, and that it's these songs are such a part of me that I don't see any reason not to have them around as often as I can.
I guess part of the reason why I ask is I know for some Black performers it's assumed, well, of course you'll have to do spirituals whether they really want to or not.
No, I don't feel any obligation. I just feel that it's just a natural thing that simply happens. I don't feel that it's something that I have to do. It's something that I do because I love it, just as I love to breathe.
You're a very religious person?
I think so, yes.
How do you think of your gift? Do you think of it as being a gift? I mean, how do you
put
that
in perspective? As a gift. I think of it as a responsibility. I think of it as a special something that I have that I can share with a lot of people. And I think of it as something very special that I have for me. Absolutely. I do think of it as a gift.
You know, looking at you, you're really such a striking woman, and you're wearing these wonderfully colored clothes, and
you have a
beautiful, like, blue satin bag with a rose sitting on top of it as you speak. And I'm thinking that traditionally divas have always had a reputation for a glamour both on and off the stage. And I wonder if that came naturally to you or if it's something that you took on with time as you grew into your role.
I don't know. I love beauty. I love beautiful trees. I love beautiful clothes. I love beautiful paintings. I like to wear things that I think make me look nice. I don't know that has anything to do with glamour, but I think it has to do with a certain aesthetic sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What are your plans for the future?
My plans for the future? Well, I like to go on with this job. I like it very much. I like singing, and I want to get to be better at it. And I will continue this hopping across the pond, as I call it, going back and forth between America and Europe and America and Japan and Australia or South America or even somewhere as near as Canada, traveling around the world, sort of singing for people. I just like to go on doing that.
You know, we talked earlier about how in some areas there have been roles defined by race, where Blacks wouldn't be cast in certain roles. Mm-hmm. Is this a problem anymore?
I'm sure that it must be. It would be unrealistic of me to suggest that, oh, no, this isn't a problem. I don't think that, certainly in my lifetime, that it will come to pass that there will be people all over the world that have completely forgotten about the differences in race because the differences are there. But as far as I'm concerned, and I've always said this, the differences do not for me define limitations. Because the only limitations that I have, I feel, as a singer, or what my brain can handle and what my voice can do. And whether or not there are people that might hire me to sing somewhere who might have an idea that I can't do something because I'm Black, well, that's their problem, because I really do not have a problem with this, because I know, as I've always said, and as I said rather naively as a young child, my brain is the same color, and so are my vocal cords.
Jesse Norman, it's really been a pleasure to meet you. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been diva Jesse Norman. This is Fresh Air. On the next program, I'll speak with writer Kati Martin. She's a former ABC News correspondent who, for many years, lived in Europe with her husband, Peter Jennings. She's written a semi-autobiographical novel titled An American Woman, so I hope you can join us. ¶¶ Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with award-winning obituary writer Jim Nicholson. He's turned his obituary page into a place to celebrate the lives of truck drivers, maids, and bartenders. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the early days of the Beatles. Book critic John Leonard reviews Waltzing with a Dictator, Raymond Bonner's analysis of U.S. relations with deposed Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos. And we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. And now the news. This is Fresh Air. When the Beatles first came to the United States, many of us wondered about all the other great bands in Liverpool we were missing out on. Fresh Air's rock historian Ed Ward says, "Don't worry, we didn't miss that much," and he's got proof.
That at this late date, the Beatles' early records don't sound like too much to people hearing them for the first time. They sound thin and crude, and the horrible racket people complain so much about is practically soothing next to what today's kids listen to. But in order to see why the Beatles were so revolutionary when they first hit, we have to take a closer look at Liverpool in 1962. Ever since Britain had started manufacturing its own rock and roll, or what passed for it, it had been made in London. The high unemployment in Liverpool, on the other hand, had people hustling, and one hustle they tried was music. The Liverpool scene had actually been going on since the late 50s, not only with musicians, but painters, actors, writers, poets, and comedians. Much as London wanted to ignore it, it couldn't. Bill Harry edited the Mersey Beat newspaper that chronicled the whole thing. One day he took a count and discovered 350 working bands in Liverpool, including 40 country groups. Before the Mersey Sound hit, British rock and roll had been a parade of faceless, cute young boys with silly names like Johnny Gentle and Billy Fury. America hated them, even the one who stood apart from the pack, Cliff Richard. Cliff was touted as the British Elvis, but he was sadly closer to the British Pat Boone, and hip English kids knew that too. His band, the Shadows, was something else, though. It was their instrumentation, guitars, bass, drums, that the Liverpool groups used to play American rhythm and blues songs they learned off of records the local sailors brought home. The Shadows and R&B, that was the formula, more or less. One day, a London talent scout dared to make the train trip north, and he returned, having signed Howie Casey and the Seniors.
Don't be mad at me. I ain't mad at you. Don't
Casey's version of the Huey Piano Smith song, I Ain't Mad at You, was a valiant effort, especially considering how bad British rock and roll had been up till then. And it focused attention on Liverpool as Britain's pop mecca. Casey's star faded as better groups like The Searchers, The Big Three, King Size Taylor and the Dominoes, and Farron's Flamingos came to the fore. But Paul McCartney remembered, and you can hear Howie Casey playing sax on Wings' Band on the Run album. Another pioneering Liverpool beat group was Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Today, they're remembered mostly for giving the Beatles their drummer, Ringo Starr. And on the basis of what I've heard, that's sufficient. Check out this early recording and notice the drumming. It's bad enough to be very early Ringo.
Well, I can tell by the way that you look at me. I can tell, pretty baby, it's so plain to see.
I think I'm just playing the worst Merseybeat records I could find, but actually, most of the early stuff sounds like this. As crude as they were, the first Beatle recordings were far more spirited, far more technically accomplished, and much closer to the rock and roll feeling the British were used to getting from us.
No wonder that in Liverpool, London, and even in America, teenagers agreed that they'd never dance to another once they'd seen them standing there.
Rock historian Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle and is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
You're listening to Fresh Air.
My guest is Jim Nicholson, a Philadelphia Daily News obituary writer with a cult following. No longer do his readers think of the obit desk as the first stop for an aspiring rookie or a Siberia for a wayward reporter. His obits have been described by one of his editors as folk art. He thinks of his work as oral history. Nicholson's obits celebrate the lives of people who were never famous or wealthy or influential outside of the neighborhood. The people he's written about include a former ice hauler, a trash truck driver, a housewife, and a domestic. Along with his devoted Philadelphia readership, Nicholson has a recent Distinguished Writing Award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors to testify to his unusual achievement. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I've chosen some excerpts of obituaries that you've written that I'd like for you to read for us.
Okay. The first one is Joseph Joe the Goat DeRito. Hardly anyone, including his family, is exactly sure what he did during his 20 years at the Philadelphia Parking Authority. But that was regarded as a side job anyway. His principal occupation was just being Joe the Goat. Trash truck hauler Leon H. Grant. He had rigged a speaker system inside the cab to hear music, and the booties of his latest grandchild usually hung from the visor. A religious man who was an active member of Devereux United Methodist Church, Grant was described as the one who taught his children to pray, and then taught his grandchildren. Lawrence Larry Dimples Mallary, ex-cabbie. Handsome with wavy chestnut hair and a quick smile, Larry Dimples was a sharp dresser and a real good dancer who was a lover boy who never lacked for female friends, said his sister. He was a smooth talker. He had personality, looks, what else?
This last obituary that you read, this is not the kind of guy who you'd usually read about on an obituary page. He did not lead a celebrated life. I don't know if there were any big landmarks in his life. Why did you choose him to write about on your obituary page?
Well, Terry, like most people on my obituary page, he had no so-called credentials to even get there had it been an orthodox obit page. But he did live a life. He lived a good life. Larry was one of the guys you see on the corner, and you wonder where Larry's life goes when he leaves the corner. Larry is that old guy you see in the fast food place having the cigarette and cup of coffee and looking out under a very old furrowed brow at people walking by, and you catch a glance at him and you say, what brought him to this chair in this fast food place or this all-night diner? And what we try to do in about 15 or 20 inches is run his life back in fast reverse and see where he started and what brought him here.
Did you know right away when you started the obit page that you wanted to write obituaries about people from the neighborhoods?
Yes, from the very first obit, October 18th, 1982, was on a stakeout police officer who had died. And it's been that way ever since. There was never any question.
I think of your obituaries as being a little like eulogies in that they describe the person from the perspective of people who knew them and loved them and who loved their eccentricities and appreciated them for that. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, they are eulogies. In fact, some priests and ministers will read them from the pulpit at a service. Being in a newspaper, it gives it almost a false sense of authority. You know, the printed word, it must be true, and this is important. So they'll hold the clipping at the service and say, here's what they said in the Daily News about so-and-so. He must be important because it's in the newspaper.
Most feature stories and articles in newspapers just get thrown out after they're read. I bet your obituaries are saved for many years.
Oh, my gosh, Terry, they're almost immortal. The greatest investigative piece I ever wrote when I thought I was really important never survived more than a few weeks in terms of being kept around. But these obituaries, they're laminated. They're put under glass. They're hung on walls. They're in family Bibles. In fact, they're even put into the inside coat pocket of the deceased. And, they'll be around long after you and I are gone.
You get people to tell you wonderful things. This is from one of your obituaries. You write, he was an expert driver who could weave a car through heavy traffic in record time while singing a romantic ballad. He knew the words to every mushy song from the 1930s through the 1950s. That's great. I mean, who would tell a reporter that?
Well, they don't tell you this right at first. Initially, people in a phone interview, and most of mine are by phone, will tell you what is proper and right and they think should be on the record. But very, very few people in this world can talk to somebody for more than an hour. And we see this on police interrogations that run on for 3 hours until finally you start getting to the core of who this person was. And after they give their initial four-minute prepared speech on the person, then we get into who this person really was.
Many of us spend considerable time wondering about and worrying about our own deaths. Has being this involved with death, writing about it every day, made you think about death more?
I don't think about it any more than the average person, I suppose. And I don't carry any emotional excess baggage from doing the job, I don't think. But what it has done, it's made me admire the average person for all the things that they do with their lives, the volunteer work that they do. And I do a lot of stories where people are facing death over a period of a year or 2 years, and how they get their affairs in order and the great courage that they have to do this. I guess it has affected me a little bit. I have always been a day-at-a-time person and enjoy what you've got, but it's even more so now.
Your obituary page has become very popular, and I imagine a lot of people pursue you now so that you can write an obituary about their deceased friend or relative. How do you decide who you're actually going to cover?
Generally, I'm not pursued that heavily that I can't handle it yet, but I've been able to write obits on virtually everybody who calls, and it's sufficient. And I get calls from, say, a 14-year-old girl from the ghetto in North Philadelphia who doesn't go through any bureaucracy. She just dials my number and says, I want to talk about my grandmom. And presto, the next day, this girl's grandmom has a 18-inch obit with picture. Now, where else can this happen? It can't happen anywhere. You know, people can't get into newspapers anymore. The guard stops them downstairs, unless you're a crooked politician or a movie star. How are you going to get into a newspaper today?
Have you ever had to say to anybody, I'm sorry, but your mother or your grandmother isn't interesting enough or important enough to get into the paper?
Never, never. Nonsense. There is no uninteresting obits. Only uninteresting questions asked by a reporter.
There's a lot of obituary jokes. I know one or two, like, I always read the obituaries to see if I'm dead, and people are dying who never died before. Do people tell you a lot of obit jokes?
I am the butt of a lot of obit jokes. myself and the Inquirer obituary writer, we've heard them all, and you know, they nickname me Dr. Death and all this sort of thing. And so I get back at them sometimes. In the elevator, I'll say to someone, Charlie, do you have a recent picture of yourself? And they'll look at me twice.
I guess, in a way, I hate to bring this up, but you know that now you will be eligible for one of the really large official obituaries because you've made such an important contribution to the city. It's a funny thing to bring up.
Well, I suppose I have not written my own obituary. I like to think that my obituary is already being written in a lot of little obituaries. It's already out there.
Jim Nicholson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jim Nicholson is the obituary writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, we're following the burial of the victims of the Stark attack that took place at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. Also, the swearing-in of Judge Webster as the new CIA director. And we'll be talking with former Navy Secretary John Layman, his thoughts on what happened with the USS Stark.
I understand you're going to have another report on AIDS from Laurie Garrett.
Yes, Laurie was in Newark, which is the place where it's the highest incidence of AIDS in the country. This time, a horrible story about a foster mother who took on the children of a heroin addict. It turns out that 4 of the 6 children had AIDS.
Okay, Robert, thank you very much. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The United States' relationship with the Philippines and its former president, Ferdinand Marcos, is the subject of a new book called Waltzing with a Dictator. Its author is Raymond Bonner, who's a former New York Times foreign correspondent. Our book critic, John Leonard, says Bonner has produced a searing account of this chapter in American foreign policy.
The bad news from Ray Bonner is that we did it again. In the Philippines, as in Iran, as in Nicaragua, we manufactured a dictator and sustained him in his dreadful office just long enough for him to invent the enemies who would hate us as much as they hated him. Never mind that Ferdinand Marcos and Imelda, the singing sexpot, the dragon lady with the butterfly sleeves, corrupted the courts, the schools, the army, and the political process. Never mind that he tortured his opponents and stole his elections and looted the treasury of almost $10 billion. Never mind that his peculiar form of state capitalism makes the mixed economy of the Sandinistas look like a valentine to Adam Smith. In the Philippines, all the timber, sugar, coconuts, banks, newspapers, radio and TV stations, and gambling casinos were divvied up among Marcos' relatives and cronies. And who cares anymore about his $2 million in illegal campaign contributions to Richard Nixon? It may not even matter that our CIA did its best to dirty every Filipino government after the end of the Japanese occupation, that our Pentagon licked the boots of the tin pot in exchange for military bases, that our State Department and every president since LBJ winked at the greedy plunder and the martial law and the stomach-turning human rights abuses. The best that can be said for us is that we dumped him a minute or two before the bitter end, keeping the bloodshed down to a minimum for the time being. But fix on this. When Marcos declared martial law in 1972, and we knew in advance that he would, and we did nothing to stop it, there were only 350 armed guerrillas in the Philippines, with a few thousand sympathizers. Today there are 20,000 armed guerrillas in the Philippines, with perhaps a 500,000 sympathizers. What a success story. And these radicals have their doubts about the telegenic Cory, who doesn't seem willing to redistribute any of her own vast landholdings to peasants who are close to starving. Ray Bonner was a public interest lawyer in San Francisco before he became a reporter. His prize-winning stories for the New York Times from El Salvador enraged Jesse Helms and the Wall Street Journal. He spent 3 years in the Philippines. He has interviewed hundreds of the players and read thousands of documents secured through the Freedom of Information Act. He seems sometimes to be talking to us through clenched teeth, as if about to gag or scream. Whenever he feels himself to have gone on too long about corruption in Manila or hypocrisy in Washington, he will pause to tell another Imelda shopping story. These buying binges are almost a narrative conceit, like amnesia on the TV soaps. Buy a bauble, torture a prisoner, listen to a State Department apparatchik congratulate himself. It's all here, the whole ugly story. My only complaint is that I think the Philippines are different from Iran and Nicaragua. Any American who has ever visited the archipelago should feel a special sense of shame. This country, three times as populous as Australia, was a spoil of the Spanish-American War. It became our baby. We made it speak our own language so that it could hate us in English. We wrote the Constitution that Marcos destroyed. We fouled our own colonial nest. We deserve bad dreams.
Fresh Air book critic John Leonard reviews television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's a preview of our next show. Next time, I'll speak with writer Julian Barnes. Critics praised his novel Flaubert's Parrot for its imaginative blending of fiction and biography. His new novel is called Staring at the Sun. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recording by soprano Benita Valente. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss how we overuse the words legend and legendary. So I hope you can join us for another edition of our legendary program. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Here's a preview of our next show. Next time, I'll speak with writer Julian Barnes. Critics praised his novel, Flaubert's Parrot, for its imaginative blending of fiction and biography. His new novel is called Staring at the Sun. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recording by soprano Benita Valente. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss how we overuse the words legend and legendary. So I hope you can join us for another edition of our legendary program. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.